we'll do a little meditation about ignorance, that's antidote. But before we do that, it's important to understand why it's important to do that meditation. So if we start off with our basic experience of unpleasant situations occurring in our life, not only gross suffering, but the fact that our happy circumstances disappear and go away. They don't last forever. We have to trace the causes for these experiences. And our unpleasant circumstances are rooted in the ignorance, anger, and attachment that make us do negative actions that then bring forth unhappy experiences. So if we trace it back, we trace the unhappiness to the negative actions, to the disturbing attitudes, and to the root of all the roots, the ignorance. When we're unhappy, the root ignorance that founded that is double-fold. One part is an ignorance that doesn't understand the deeper level of existence, how things exist. And the other part is an ignorance that doesn't understand cause and effect. And so because we have ignored cause and effect, then we create the negative actions that bring the unhappiness. Even in the case of happiness that we have in cyclic existence, it doesn't last long. That happiness is also rooted in our positive actions. But that and those positive actions are rooted in positive qualities in our mind. But because all of this is still within the realm of cyclic existence and the happiness doesn't last long, then we know that ignorance is again at the basis of that. And here it's simply the ignorance that doesn't understand the deeper level of existence. We're still grasping at positive actions and happiness and all these things as being inherently existent. But there's not the ignorance of cause and effect involved in creating the positive actions. So in either situation, happiness or unhappiness in cyclic existence, both of them are somewhat unsatisfactory because they don't last long. Always changing. We don't have much control over it. So to free ourselves from that situation, then we have to root out the ignorance that doesn't understand or that misunderstands the mode of existence, the deeper way that things exist. So we'll do a little contemplation on how to do that right now. So this ignorance that grasps that inherent existence thinks of both people and phenomena as inherently existent. But the biggest difficulty is thinking of our own self as inherently existent. Because when we have a strong sense of a solid, independent I, then we easily get attached to it and angry at anything that gets in its way. So when we have this strong feeling of an independent I, this grasping, are we grasping at anything that in fact exists? When we have this strong grasping, we just automatically assume that what we're grasping at exists. But let's for now not assume it. We'll investigate and see if it does. So we'll first generate that grasping and see how the self, the I, appears to exist at that time. So remember a time when your feelings got hurt, or when you were made extremely angry, when you felt guilty or inferior, sometime when there was a very intense emotion like that, a negative emotion. And try and generate that again in the mind. Generate that feeling of somebody is accusing me falsely, or somebody doesn't respect me, or someone's trashing me. Generate that strong feeling. And then with one corner of your eye, just be aware of the sense of self, the sense of I. How does that I feel like it exists? Usually feels pretty concrete, pretty solid. There's me. Like I don't depend on anything. Existence of me does not depend on anything. I'm just there as a solid, independent, autonomous thing. Now if such an I, a self, existed, we should be able to find it the more we investigate. We should be able to find the I that is offended or hurt or angry. We should be able to find that independent I that sets itself up from its own side. And there's only a few places we can look for it. It's either got to be somewhere in our body and mind, or something totally separate from our body and mind. So still, holding that feeling of the very strong sense of an independent I, let's begin to investigate and see if we can find it. So focus on your body. Can you find the I, the self, yourself, me, in the body? Am I my foot? Am I my stomach? Is my heart me? Is my brain me? especially somewhere behind the eyes. Sometimes it feels like I'm there. Where? We could open the skull. Would we find me? So look through all the parts of your body and see if one of them is you. See if there's some material thing that's you somewhere there. We can't really find any part of the body where we can locate the self. Or any part of the body that is me. So really feel, I am not my body. I've looked in my body for myself. I am not this body. This body is not me. Well then, am I in my mind? If I'm the mind, then I should be able to find the moment of mind that is me. Or a specific thought, a specific type of consciousness, a specific emotion that is me. So we've been studying the mind in this class. All the different primary consciousnesses, all the different secondary consciousnesses, the mental factors. Are any of them me? Am I the visual consciousness or the auditory consciousness? Am I the mental consciousness? Well, maybe yes. Well, then, am I the mental consciousness that sleeps? Or the moment of mental consciousness that thinks? Which thought am I? So many thoughts, which one is me? Can you find any feeling? Any thought, any consciousness. You can say, this is me. This is the solid, independent me. Check. Try and find it. Find any thought, any consciousness, any mental factor that we can isolate alone and say, this is who I am. This is me. So make a firm decision. I'm not my mind either. My mind is not me. It's not this solid, independent me. Then maybe I'm something independent of body and mind. Maybe I'm something that's sitting outside body and mind, like some kind of soul. Something separate that simply controls the body and mind. Well, if I'm a totally different entity from body and mind, then what am I? The solid I, where am I going to find it? If it's separate from body and mind, can my body and mind be one place and I am another place? And what's the nature of such an independent I, an independent self? If it's totally unrelated to the body and mind, what is it? Where are you going to find it? So check other places, check around the room, check around the universe, see if you can find the self, if it's independent from the body and mind. Make a firm decision. There's no self, independent self, that I can find anywhere separate from the body and mind. So in our investigation, looking for that solid self, remember that one that was offended, that had its feelings hurt, that was angry? We can't find it anywhere. It's not our body, it's not our mind, it's not something separate. The only thing we can conclude is that such an independent self simply doesn't exist. That what we're grasping at doesn't exist at all. And so stay in that state of non-finding of such a solid self. Stay in that feeling of emptiness, because that independent thing that you thought exists is totally unfindable. But stay in the non-finding and concentrate on that. But there is a dependent self that appears within this emptiness, because there is a body, there is a mind, and very lightly labeled on top of that combination, we just say, I. There's no independent solid self, but there is that lightly labeled I that functions in the world, that dependent I. There is that. So, I think, who are you? that meditation a bit unsettling? People were really fidgety during it. Yeah, some kind of spaciousness, huh? Yeah. Can you find some solid person that is your mind or is your Buddha nature? But we're looking for, remember in the beginning, we generated that very strong sense of me? Me, I am. That's the one we're looking for. Like when you get angry. Yeah, but at the time you're angry, you feel. You don't feel like, oh, this is a passing mood. You feel there's an I, a very strong me that is threatened, pissed off, and I'm going to get my revenge. You know, our instinctive feeling at that time is not, oh, there's just a merely labeled self. No, there's me, and this guy got my way, and this is serious business. Okay, that's the one we're looking for, that strong one. It seems like it just doesn't depend on anything else. Yeah, I mean, we have to, it's like when you're trying to find your keys, you have to keep in your mind what the keys are that you're looking for. So when we're trying to find the I, we have to know this feeling of I that we're looking for. Mm-hmm. The ignorance of the relative truth.
Right. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Not having that ignorance doesn't mean that they fully, not having that ignorance manifest at that moment doesn't mean that they fully understand cause and effect. It simply means that when somebody's, you know, doing a positive action, they don't have that part of their mind active at that time that's thinking, oh, my action has absolutely no ramification on anything else at all. Okay? So it's not like somebody has to be a Buddhist in order to do a positive action. Okay? But what it's talking about is, you know, that ignorance of the relative truth is that part that, you know, thinks there's... you know, there's absolutely no cause and effect operating here at all, so I can basically do whatever I want. So when the person is acting positively, that kind of attitude is not there at that moment. Yeah. Clearly, if we like try and get a deeper and deeper feeling for cause and effect, then that's going to motivate us to really do more positive actions. And to do them well. Yeah, it's selfish, but it's better than. But at certain levels of the path, it's fine to be selfish, because at least it's better than trampling on top of others, isn't it? Okay, so there's gradations on which we progress. Because you can see when there's this real strong feeling inside of me, you know, I mean, the mind's so contracted and tight. Okay, so this is actually quite an important meditation. So when they talk about realizing emptiness, it's a very specific kind of thing that we're looking at the emptiness of. It's not empty mind. It's not blank mind. It's not nothingness. It's, you know, a very specific thing. And that's why understanding that mental factor of ignorance, you know, what it is that we're conceiving to exist, you know, that we're grasping at, and then investigating to see if we can actually find that. So that's why they say actually the most difficult thing in the whole meditation is to become aware of that instinctive feeling of I. Because it's so instinctive that we aren't even aware that we're feeling it.
I also read in the teachings they say that the selflessness of persons with this meditation is supposed to be
Mm-hmm. And the selflessness of phenomena.
Which I don't think that's the case. I mean, for me, I thought like, you know, the example of a car and analyzing a car and thinking
right.
Easier.
Yeah. I remember one day with Geshe La, we got into this too. Yeah, this was my question to him. Okay. So the answer, you know, because I said the same thing. The car, it's very easy. I can understand how there's no, you know, solid car there. So why do you say that's harder than realizing that there's no me? And so what he explained is that the car is being used as an example of phenomena. If we take another example, let's say like the body, okay, we might feel that it's easier to realize the selflessness of the body rather than the selflessness of the I, the self, or the emptiness of the body rather than the emptiness of the I, because it seems like, okay, I can mentally dissect my body and it's all these parts and there's no overall body that's holding it together. But that's an intellectual understanding. And what he said is that the I is imputed on top or designated on top of the body and mind, so it's more unstable because it's dependent on the body and mind. So the thing that is imputed on top of something else is easier to recognize the emptiness of than the thing it's imputed on top of. So that's why he said it's easier. Yeah? And here he's not talking about just intellectual understanding, but gut feeling understanding. Okay. Okay. Well, maybe. I'll think about that, Geshe. Yeah. Yeah, we have the eyes imputed on top of the body and mind, so it's easier, it's more unstable, easier to see how it's imputed. Okay?
Does that mean the concept of car as you're looking at it, is that what's imputed on the actual object of car, and that would be easier to...
No, it's like car is imputed on, you know, the hood and the engine and the wheels and the steering wheel and all those things. And so when we're doing the analysis, it's initially easier to see how the car is empty because, you know, it's imputed on top of something else than rather than going to the thing it's imputed on top of. Okay. And, you know, but they also say that when you realize the emptiness of one thing, such as the self, then it becomes very easy. All you do is, when you have direct realization of emptiness, okay, without concept, then all you do is simply turn your mind to another object and, you know, very quickly you realize the emptiness of that other object. So it's not like you need to go through this whole meditation with every single existing thing in the universe. You know? So at that point, we do get a shortcut. Yeah. I had a friend when I was in college said that. He had his whole life planned out. You know, I'm going to do 4 years of undergrad and 4 years of medical school, 4 years of residency, and then do this, and then I'm going to get married, and then I'm going to have the kids, and then I'm going to get my kids to college, and then I'm going to buy this, and then I'm going to move here, and then I'm going to die and finally relax. Heavy. Yeah, because the body and mind is the basis of imputation. And the I is the thing imputed. Okay? So whenever you have the appearance of the basis of imputation, the aggregates of body and mind, and on top of that you have the appearance of I, and then we grasp at that appearance as being something real and solid. The I, because it's merely labeled on top of the body and mind, is easier to recognize the emptiness of that, because it's more unstable in the sense that it was the thing that was labeled on top of something else. It's the thing that's dependent on something else. It's like, I guess, stacking up cans. The one on the top is the easiest to topple over. So we'll, what we just did was talking a lot about this one called Jitta, the wrong view of the transitory collection. But that's jumping ahead, so let's just do doubt, and then we'll get into deluded views and Jitta. Okay, so we'll cycle back to this. Okay, so deluded doubt, the next one. Okay, it's a mental factor which is indecisive and wavering, and tends towards an incorrect conclusion about important points such as actions and their results, the Four Noble Truths, the Three Jewels, and so forth. Okay? And so this one, it's, they call it some, we can see when we have doubting mind, we are indecisive and wavering, aren't we? And this is a particular kind of deluded doubt. There's different kinds of doubt, yeah? There's some kind of doubt that's inclined toward the positive conclusion. It's still doubt, but it's an okay. I mean, it's doubt, but it's not this deluded doubt, okay? Or there's another kind of doubt that's kind of, well, could be this, I'm not sure, okay? That also is, it's not so good, but it's not quite as bad as this deluded one. Here with this deluded doubt, we're talking about this indecisive, wavering mind, but it's really inclined towards the wrong conclusion. So it's like, well, I don't really know if there's past and future rebirths, but I really don't think there is. Okay? That kind of thing. And so what makes doubt so difficult is that we can't move when we're doubting. We're stuck. So they say that doubt is like a two-pointed needle. If you try and sew something with a two-pointed needle, you get stuck, don't you? Wherever you put it, you can't move. You can't, you know, stitch anything up because the needle has two points. So similarly, when we have doubt, we have, you know, I'm doubting between this and this and this. Sometimes we have three or four points to our needle. So we get really, really stuck. So this kind of doubt immobilizes our practice, and we just get stuck in all of our... This is where we start spinning around, and we just get real, real confused. And this happens in practice sometimes. It's kind of a very natural occurrence. I remember, you know, I kind of went through... when I first met Dharma, kind of like the first year was just wonderful, you know. Like, wow, I finally found this thing that makes sense, and this is great. And then after 1 year, I started going, well, how do I know the Buddha really exists? How do I know karma really exists? How do I know it's really possible to become enlightened? Now, and all these doubts came up, okay? And so it's a very natural thing that we have this doubting mind. Yeah? It's when the doubts start inclining toward the wrong conclusion that then we get quite stuck and immobile. When we're still wondering and doubting, well, does this or doesn't this, then sometimes that inspires like a curiosity, and we can actually start investigating more and go and ask questions or read or go to more teachings or discuss with Dharma friends. You know, so when we have doubt, we should try and ask questions and resolve it. But when we get to this kind of, you know, when we get, you know that mood you get in when no matter what anybody else says, you're just going to say, well, how do you know that? You know that one? Yeah, it's kind of a five-year-old mind that's kind of, how to say, it just wants to make trouble. Yeah, a certain contrariness. It just wants to make trouble. It doesn't want to listen to any answers. It doesn't want to really think deeply about this. It just wants to sit there and, you know, make a lot of confusion and Make a mess. Okay, so that's this mental factor. Yeah. So lots of confusion like that, but inside of ourself. Yeah? Like soup inside. And so when we get really like that, when we start spinning around like that, when you can see it's just that five-year-old contrary mind, then it's very helpful just to do the breathing meditation. Yeah? When you can see that you're just asking questions to be a troublemaker to yourself, but you're not really wanting answers, you know, then the antidote is to just sit and calm the mind down and breathe. When you're having kind of a curiosity about stuff and you want to investigate, then investigate. Yeah. And that can spur you on. That's quite good. Okay. So this doubt is not about, you know, doubting like, you know, who should I vote for, or, you know, what lottery number is going to win, or, you know, who beat up who on the playground. You know, it's not that kind of doubt. This is doubt about kind of important, you know, things that influence our whole belief system. Okay? Because if we're doubting things like if it's possible to become enlightened, or if we're doubting things like karma, that's going to definitely influence how we act in our life and how we view life altogether. Okay. Anybody have questions about this deluded doubt? Okay. If it's the deluded doubt where we're just being contrary and just being kind of then meditate on the breath. Yeah. Whenever you find that like you're spinning and you can't make sense of something, and, I mean, you know, there's sometimes when we're really investigating and trying to make sense of something, that's fine. But when sometimes you just hit a brick wall and you're just spinning and, you know, it's just, then stop. Don't try and go on at that point. Just come back to the breath and settle the mind down and let it clear out. Okay, so that we got rid of deluded doubt quick. We're ready to go on to deluded views. Okay. So this is sometimes called mistaken views, or deluded views. So this is either a deluded intelligence that regards the aggregates as being inherently I or mine, or in direct dependence upon such a view. Okay, so this is... this is kind of a speculative kinds of thing. It's a deluded intelligence. So it is a factor of intelligence, but it's a deluded one. Okay, which is why we need another factor of intelligence to oppose it, because we really need to refute these things. Okay, so there's a few kinds of different deluded intelligence. One regards the aggregates. Okay, aggregates means the body and mind, the five aggregates. One is physical. The body is the physical aggregate. And then we have four mental aggregates. One is feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness. Those are the four mental aggregates. Okay? So a deluded intelligence that regards the aggregates as being inherently I or mine, which when we just did that meditation and we were having that strong feeling of I there, that's this one. Okay? So if you look through on the five different kinds of deluded views, this is the first one, view of the transitory collection. Okay? And then the second part of the definition, or in direct dependence upon such a view. So in direct dependence upon view of the transitory collection, a deluded intelligence that develops further wrong conceptions. So that's B, C, D, and E. Okay? Those four other wrong conceptions. That's what that second part of it is referring to. Okay, so this
Mm.
No, this is referring also to the innate feeling of the self. Okay? Like I was saying, in the philosophical school, sometimes they'd have a lot of debate about the relationship between this one jitta, this first one, and ignorance. But basically, if we go according to Prasangika Majjhimika, then they say that this first one is an innate feeling about our own self. It's not referring to other people. It's not referring to phenomena. This one's referring specifically to ourself, and it's an innate one. Okay? Then there is an artificial kind of it, which is when we get all caught up in our philosophy. Okay? And there's a soul and blah, 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 blah. Okay? Okay, so the deluded views, they function, they act as a basis for all of our troubles, and through them we generate all the other disturbing attitudes, as well as all the other faults and incorrect conceptions and incorrect outlooks. Okay? So there's many, many kinds of deluded views, but here we're talking about five principal ones. And so these are all a form of deluded intelligence. And they're pinpointing like the chief major, deluded views. But, you know, like my teachers say, we have lots of them. You can loan them out. Interest-free. Okay. Very generous. Okay, so this first one, view of the transitory collection. I'm going to call this one jigta. That's the Tibetan name, and it's much less of a mouthful than view of the transitory collection. Okay, so if you'll excuse me, but I will explain why it's called view of the transitory collection. Okay, transitory, because the aggregates, you know, the five aggregates are transitory. They're impermanent. They rise and cease moment by moment. Okay? So they're changing moment by moment. That's why they're called transitory. And collection, because they are made up of parts and because they in turn come together and create something. Okay? So just by the very definition, there, or just by the name, view of the transitory collection, we can automatically see by that that there's no fixed unitary soul. Okay, because when we have a feeling that there's a unitary solid soul, what are the characteristics of such a soul? Well, first of all, it's not a collection, it's one thing, it's me. Okay, and second of all, it's not transitory, it doesn't change moment by moment, it's permanent. So actually, this grasping that we have at a soul in the kind of Hindu or with some Christians, the sense of a Christian soul, some fixed thing that doesn't change moment to moment, that is singular, okay, that exists independent of other things, it doesn't have hearts, it doesn't have causes and conditions, it isn't something that's created, it's not something that's changed, okay, that you can see right away that kind of notion is, you know, doesn't exist. It's a type of wrong view. And that kind of notion is actually an artificial type of deluded view. It's not the innate jigta. It's an artificial one. But it's funny because you can see, well, it's not funny, it's sad, but we can see how deeply ingrained even these artificial ones are in us. Because how, you know, if we have the concept that there's some kind of permanent fixed soul, we can really hold on to that quite tightly, can't we? So that to the point where it doesn't feel like it's, first of all, we don't even feel like it's wrong, and we feel like it's right. And second of all, we don't even feel like it's an idea we made up. We feel like it's a reality. It seems quite stuck in us. But in actual fact, this is something that comes about through wrong philosophies. Okay, now to go into this one about jigta, I was going over this trying to prepare for the class tonight, and I'm thinking, well, how much depth do I go into about this? Because we can get into all sorts of philosophical things here, and we'll all get totally lost. And yet I want to be able to give you enough so that you get some feeling of what this one is. So I'm not sure what's going to happen. Okay? But I just want to let you know that whatever you do get, it isn't the full complete story, because this is talked about in the Majjhimika, the middle way view, in text after text after text, okay? So this is like a big topic, this one, okay? But, okay, but we're conceiving the on the basis of the body and mind, okay? We have the appearance of the body and mind, and together with that we have the appearance of a self that's labeled on top of them. And and I'm talking now according to Prasangika Majjhimika view, that because there's different philosophical tenets and they all have a different take on how they describe this mental factor. Okay, so it's really quite elaborate, this whole thing. But anyway, so we have the appearance of the body and mind on top, and with that, you know, the appearance of an eye that's just lightly labeled, and then this one focuses on that lightly labeled eye and holds it and says, ugh, you know, this thing is solid and independent. It doesn't depend on causes and conditions. It doesn't depend on parts. It doesn't depend on any kind of mind conceiving it and labeling it. It's just there from its own side, setting itself up independent of anything else. Okay? So that's how they describe that gut feeling of I or self that we were trying to get in touch with at the beginning of the meditation. So we can say the words and describe it, but to recognize that gut feeling in ourself is actually quite difficult, because we're so used to having it. Yeah, we can't even pick it out. Okay, so it grasps at either an inherently existent I or an inherently existent mind. Okay? So the I is what I just described. The mind is another way of talking about I, but it's talking about I a little bit different. It's talking about I as the thing that makes something mine. It's talking about I as being the owner. Okay? So when we talk about mine. It's a slightly different than talking about I when, you know, we're talking about I go here and I go there, I do this and that. This one's like the way of looking at I, where it's the maker of possession, the maker of things into mind, the owner of things. Yeah. And we feel that very strong. This is my clock. This is my body. Yeah. Who's the my that's the possessor of the body? It's very interesting to look at. Yeah. So it's, you know, there's a very strong feeling of my, a strong feeling of mine. But who is that person that's making this into mine, that's owning this whole thing? So that's why it's saying, conceives them to be either an inherently existent I or an inherently existent mind. Okay? Because we feel that the body and mind are things controlled by the I, by the mind. They're mine. I control. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Don't we? Okay. What do you mean?
When you were saying that in India they have, I think that there is, they have their own idea of a soul.
Oh, in Hinduism, then they also often talk about the Atman or the soul, and it's very similar in many ways to the Christian idea of a soul. But this is one way in which Buddhism is really quite different from the other Indian traditions. And one way, you know, when the Buddha taught, how his system was differentiated from the Brahman system that existed before him, because they believed in this Atman or soul or self like that. And Buddha said, try and find it, folks. Okay? So he taught anatman, the lack of atman. Okay, so there's a very interesting description here about how the different disturbing attitudes arise, kind of an order of generation of them. And so it's when we're tracing the origin of cyclic existence, this is, you know, as we did at the beginning of this meditation, you know, we have cyclic existence with its suffering, traced to actions, traced to the disturbing attitudes, and then how the disturbing attitudes are traced to ignorance. Then this is starting off with jibta, and which is, we talked about last time, as being a part of ignorance, and then how from that we get all the other disturbing attitudes that then produce the karma. Okay? So if you have this jitta, which is a form of ignorance, you know, holding the inherently existent I in mind, and that exaggerates the distinction between self and others, because it makes me a real solid thing, and it makes everybody else a real solid thing. And you know, and the ignorance in general, the broader ignorance, makes everything into something really solid. So then what happens? The first disturbing attitude that comes out of that is attachment, clinging. Okay? Because there's this really solid me, and I cling to my own happiness, and I cling to everything else I can get my hands on that's going to feed my happiness. So first thing that comes up is attachment. Okay? Second thing that comes up is anger, because you know, there's a solid me, and I'm attached to the things that make me happy. So anything that gets in the way of my happiness, I get angry and have hatred for, and I want to destroy. Okay, and then from there we generate pride, because we have this puffed up view of ourselves, and we puff ourselves up anymore. Some more. And from there we generate extreme views, which is this B under the deluded views, which we'll come to in a minute, which extreme views is seeing that solid self that we grasped at with jitta as either something eternal forever and ever, or something that's going to get destroyed at the time of death. So we fall into two extreme views. So that's the next one that gets generated. I'll talk about that in a little bit more. Then from there, we generate another deluded view, which is number D, or letter D, which is holding wrong ethics and conduct as supreme. And then from there, we generate C, which is holding, you know, wrong views or deluded views in general as supreme, which is thinking that all the other deluded views are great. From there we generate E, which is wrong views. And then from there we generate doubt, because we start doubting everything. So that's how they sometimes talk about the evolution of the different disturbing attitudes. So it's something that's interesting to kind of think about, you know, how one disturbing attitude leads to the next, leads to the next. Okay, so this this one of jitta, it's present in animals as well as in human beings. It's not just us, but, you know, you see it in my cats all the time. Yeah, we see it in insects, we see it in everything, you know, this sense of there being a me. Okay, so again, there's two types. There's different ways of saying there's two types. One way is to say that there's the artificial one, it's generated by wrong philosophies, and then there's the innate one that goes from life to life, that we have that kind of grasping at the self that occurs even, you know, when we're first born, when we're infants. Okay, so even an infant can't distinguish very well what, you know, what its own parts are. An infant scares itself when it cries out. But still there's the strong feeling of I. Okay, or there's, or we can just talk about jitta as having, in another way, us talking about inherently existent I or inherently existent mind, which I just talked about. Okay, so there's a lot to go into here, but I don't want to make it too confusing. Yeah, yeah, okay. Because we're talking about these as being the root disturbing attitudes, the things that cause cyclic existence to happen. So if we can overcome them, it's definitely desirable for happiness. Okay. So when you get into studying about emptiness more in depth, then they often talk about different levels of the object to be negated. Yeah, different ways that we grasp at the I. So they may start out with this very rough way when we're talking about a soul, you know, that feeling inside of us that there's an I, a self, that's totally separate from the body and mind. Okay, so that feeling that, you know, and we have it sometimes, don't we? Yeah, like I'm totally separate from the body and mind, you know. There's just this soul that can float out of my body, that can drop the body, drop the mind, and there's just pure me-ness. Yeah? So that one is a very, very gross level of this. It's an artificial kind. And yet, as I said, that one can really seem like a very gut feeling to us, but it's actually even quite artificial. Yeah? So that one is the first level of thing that we begin to negate, because we begin to see, well, actually it's totally impossible that there's a self that is separate from the body and mind. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense at all. Because if there were a self that's separate from the body and mind could be here and I could be over there. Yeah. Nobody thinks that. Yeah. In our body. But if you look at it, that's mind. That's consciousness, isn't it? It's the sense, it's the appearance to the mind that the mind is different from the body. Okay? So it's not like if there were really such a thing that if you could really have the body and mind here and I over here totally separate, then since all our capacity to be aware and perceive is in the mind over here, then there couldn't possibly be any awareness of being out of the body over here, because the I couldn't have any faculty of awareness because it's a totally separate entity from the mind. Yeah. So here we're really getting into, you know, the relationship between I and mind. And how we're really beginning to see how we have all these really crazy views about the relationship between the two. Because sometimes we feel I am my mind. And sometimes we feel I'm totally separate from my mind. But if we look at it, you know, the self and the mind cannot be two separate entities. So it couldn't possibly be something up here that has the capacity of consciousness if consciousness is over here. Okay? So that the I, the self, has to be something that's dependent on the body, on the body and mind, on its basis of invitation. Yeah, but that's your mind stream that continues. Yeah, that's okay. The mind and the body are two separate entities. I mean, they interrelate. They're dependent upon each other when we're alive, but they have different continuities. But see, are we our mind? Is our mind me? That's what we're asking here. Okay, if I am my mind, then in every sentence, if I and mind are the same thing, then every time I use the word I should be able to use the word mind, because they're the exact same thing. So if I say I'm walking down the street, then I should be able to say mind is walking down the street. Well, mind is not walking down the street, body's walking down the street. Okay?
No,
Yeah. Yeah. Okay? Yeah. 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 It's an appearance to the mind that we left our body. Yeah? It's an appearance to the mind. Well, all this is appearance to the mind. Okay. If you think of a rabbit's horn, does a rabbit horn exist? Now, if you dream of a rabbit's horn, does a rabbit horn exist? Just because something appears to the mind doesn't necessarily mean that it exists the way it appears, or that thing is the way we conceived it to be. So, you know, whether your mind actually leaves your body, I have no idea. But whatever it is, it's an appearance to the mind. Who knows what...
Label.
Yeah, I mean, who knows what really happened? But there was definitely the appearance to the mind, like, that there was that strong feeling. You get what I mean? Mine just left again. Yeah, sometimes it is. And see, that's the thing about the way we label I, is it's actually labeled. It's labeled on top of the body and mind. So in this case, it would be the very subtle body, the subtle energy. But sometimes it appears more towards the body. Sometimes it appears more towards the mind. When we say, I'm eating, then although the eye is still, you know, labeled on top of the body and mind, it's kind of referring more to a function of the body at that time. Yeah. If we say, I'm thinking, then it's getting labeled more on the side of the mind. Okay. Or sometimes when we just say, I, and, you know, then it's something labeled on top of the mind stream. Okay. But then the mind stream is not something findable either. And when you watch, as we start to discuss this, what our mind always does is it wants to grasp onto something. It wants to hold on to something. And we talk, yes, there's a relatively existent I, isn't there? You know, there's I. And so we have a real hard time finding the relative I, because as soon as we think I, we make it concrete. So in the same way, as soon as we think mind stream, we automatically, it becomes one concrete thing. Yeah. Yeah, my mind stream, you know, the my, and then there's the mind stream, and there are all these, you know. But when you start to look at it, yeah, I mean, what's mind stream? What are you going to find out? What are you going to label and isolate and say that's mind stream? You know, so we're back where we started from. Okay, so in this very gross way of misinterpreting I and solidifying I, we could think of I as a totally separate entity, you know, than the aggregate. So that's this idea of some self that's like way out here, and the body and mind are here. But that isn't exactly, you know, I mean, if we look at it, it's kind of impossible that body and mind are here and I'm over there. Well, no, because they're separate entities. So you could pinch the body and I wouldn't feel anything. Because I'm totally unrelated to the body and mind. Yeah? Okay. Then there's another... that's the very, very gross misinterpretation of the I. Then the next layer beneath that is called the self-sufficient, substantially existent. No, it's a little bit different. And the differences in all of these it gets a little bit hard to figure out. But the self-sufficient, substantially existent one. And what's confusing about this is that sometimes they give the example of this one. They give two different examples, and to me, then the two different examples are really different. So sometimes they say that the concept of a self-sufficient, substantially existent I is like the relationship between the I and the aggregate is like between a shepherd and the sheep. Okay? So the sheep are the aggregates and the shepherd is the I, and the shepherd just kind of, you know, steers the aggregates and leads it around and makes it do things. So this is very much the feeling of there being an I who's in charge and running the show. You know? Say, okay. I'm going to make up my mind about da-da-da. There's this feeling like there's an I that can control the body and mind, the shepherd and the sheep. Okay? But that one, that concept of it is similar to the first one, because it's seeing the I as a different entity from the aggregate. Okay. But then sometimes they give us another example for the self-sufficient, substantially existent I, and that is the relationship between us salespeople and the chief salesperson. Okay? And that's a different relationship than between the sheep and the shepherd. Because the sheep and the shepherd are completely different entities. The salespeople and the chief salesperson, okay, because the chief salesperson is still one of the salespeople. So that chief salesperson is not a separate entity. Yeah, it's still a salesperson, but somehow special. So this is the feeling that we have very often when we feel my mind is me. I am my mind. Okay? So this is probably the one you were thinking about, Lori. Yeah? When the I, you know, because the salespeople are like the aggregates, and then you pick out one of the salespeople and you make it a bit more important than the rest. So you pick out one of the five aggregates, you know, maybe like the consciousness. Or among that, the mental consciousness. And you make that one a little bit more important than all the other aggregates. So that, but still that's a wrong view too. Okay? Because that one, at least it's not seeing the self as a separate entity from the aggregates. It's seeing the self as the same entity with the aggregates, and the self is the same entity as the aggregates. But it's still seeing, it's not content with just seeing the self as the same entity, it's thinking the self is the aggregate. Or, you know, like the mental consciousness is the self. So not just being the same entity, but being exactly the same. Okay? So self-sufficient, substantially existent is a deeper level rather than this permanent, partless, independent one. So it's a little bit more difficult to refute. Okay, but it's there inside of us too. Then we go another layer deeper, you know, and there we find the inherently existent self, or truly existent self. So this is a self that exists, that we think exists, it doesn't really, that exists without depending upon concept or term, you know, label. Or any kind of concept of it. Okay, so okay. So the self is able to set itself up completely from its own side. It doesn't depend on the term I. It doesn't even depend on the concept I. It's something that's there somehow inside, radiating out. So that's a deeper level of the misconception that's harder to negate. But, you know, if we can get that one, then all the other ones, the easier ones, automatically fall by the wayside. Okay? So what we have here, the jigta and the ignorance, those are misconceptions, those things do exist. But the soul, the self-sufficient, substantially existent self, and the inherently existent self, those things do not exist. So when we're realizing emptiness, we're not destroying the self. We're just realizing that those three things, which never existed, never existed. Okay, so when we realize emptiness, it's not like first there was an inherently existent self and we realize emptiness and then there isn't one anymore. There never was one. We're just realizing that there wasn't one. And so what gets destroyed when we realize emptiness is all these wrong conceptions regarding the self, the ignorance, the citta, these kinds of things. Okay? So when we talk about the relatively existent self, the dependent self that does exist, you know, that's an existent phenomena that exists by being merely labeled on top of the aggregates. So what we have, the relationship between the self and the aggregates, is that the self is different from the aggregates, but it's not a different entity. It's the same entity as the aggregates, but it's not exactly the same. One day, if we start learning about some of the debate topics, then you'll understand some of this terminology. It'll make a lot more sense. But it's quite interesting just to begin to look at things and ask, you know, what's the relationship between these different things? Okay? You'll all have a real good night's sleep. Okay, so let's sit quietly.